Well, I am neither an artist nor the son of an artist, but as a sort of tribute to David Helm, I thought I would do a diagram for this talk. So, no, it won't be needed. There you go. Eat your heart out, Dave. So if you can see that, it's melodic line. And this is one of our sacred Dick Lucas principles, which has to do with identifying the main theme of any book in the Bible. This is one of the things that helps to give a sense of coherence to a consecutive series of sermons, either through an entire book or perhaps even through part of a book. It also helps in setting the interpretive context for any individual sermon that you're doing in that series. I myself find, probably a lot of you can relate to this, sometimes the melodic line emerges with a much greater clarity about two-thirds of the way through a sermon series. Kent Hughes was with us a year or two ago when he was preaching through Philippians and you were at least in chapter 3, maybe chapter 4, and still kind of going back and forth, not sure if you had the melodic line or not, and trying to get there. I do think, though, it's good to at least take a stab at it right from the beginning because it's kind of like editing. Once you put something down on paper, you can see what's wrong with it and you can adjust it and fix it. As you go along. One comment to make about the melodic line in general, I said it's the main theme of a book of the Bible. It may actually be the main theme of a cycle of stories or narratives within a book. So, for example, you might conclude that the Elijah stories in 1st and 2nd Kings, they have a sort of melodic line for those stories. That may not be exactly the same melodic line as you have for 1st Kings as a whole. Or maybe a good example is the book of Genesis. You have a pretty clear melodic line that comes through from something Joseph says at the end of the Joseph stories. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That's putting the whole set of those stories into perspective. That's not the melodic line that you have for Abraham, though, which has something to do with land and seed and covenant. And yet there may also be a melodic line for the book of Genesis as a whole that ties all of that together. But there are a couple different ways of thinking about the melodic line. I would also point out that this homiletical principle is actually based on an important literary principle, which is that works of literature have a cohesion. They have something that holds them together thematically. And so when we talk about the melodic line, we are talking about the literary as well as the logical and theological coherence of different parts of the Bible. And I would also say there's a melodic line for the Bible as a whole. Maybe a couple of melodic lines for the Bible as a whole. And that's also worth thinking about. That's part of the bigger picture of the melodic line. Now, let me just give you a couple easy examples before we get to our main topic, which is the melodic line in Exodus. Sometimes the authorial intention is stated very explicitly. Notable example of that would be the Gospel of Luke. Does anyone know where you would find the melodic line for Luke? An explicit intention of the author's purpose. Yeah, right at the beginning, right? Luke talks to Theophilus and he says, here's the kind of account I am trying to write, an orderly account, an eyewitness account, and it has this purpose in verse 4, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. I recently finished preaching a long series through the book of Luke, and I described it throughout the series as the gospel of knowing for sure, this idea of certainty. And that, I found that to be a theme that could be introduced virtually in every sermon that I preached in the whole book of Luke. Another notable example is the Gospel of John. Here's another well-known one. You could try to determine the melodic line from the opening chapter of John, but you might have a little trouble kind of narrowing it down because there are a lot of thematic motifs there, but you get a wonderful statement of John's purpose in John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Here is the purpose of the book. These things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Now, where's Paul Winters? Paul, David Helm told me you've been doing John lately. Do you have a pithy statement of the melodic line of John that you can share with us? Okay, interesting. Now, you didn't bring in this idea of belief then and life in Christ's name, which is okay. I'm not being critical of that. But that's the theme that emerged as you sort of preached and you saw the repeated emphasis running through the book of John. Okay, good. Now, when in your preaching did you come up with that melodic line? In the last week or? Yeah, so it all kind of came together. So, yeah, that confirms it. What I was saying, probably experience a lot of us have had. Other times, the purpose of a book is less explicit, but is still implicit in the narrative itself. Let me just give a quick example of that from the book of Ruth. You don't have a purpose statement for Ruth in so many words, but I think there is a purpose that's evident from the narrative itself. And particularly from the climactic announcement at the end of the book that the son of Naomi has the son of Ruth and Boaz has a son who has another son, and that son's name is David. That's really the whole point of the book, and you probably could have figured that out if you know a few things about David, even from the beginning of Ruth. Because you have the announcement that this is a story having to do with Bethlehem, and immediately your ears are kind of pricking up, and you're thinking, okay, yeah, this is going to have something to do with the royal family of Israel. And this would be a case where you get a little help with the melodic line from what comes before and what goes after, because before Ruth you have judges, and you have no king in Israel, and everyone doing what is right in his own eyes, and then lo and behold, you have a story immediately following that that leads up to the birth of David. Somehow you're going to have to account for that in your understanding of the thematic unity of the book of Ruth and your sense of its melodic line. And it is characteristic of well-constructed literary works, and maybe especially works that have some kind of didactic or pedagogic purpose. They're trying to teach you something. It is characteristic of those works that they have a predominant theme. There's a literary unity to them. Now, one cautionary word, and I'd be interested to know if David probably agrees with this. I know he's done a lot of teaching on melodic line, but we should recognize that even though there may be a melodic line that runs through the book, there may be other important motifs. To me, a good analogy of that is the way a symphony works. I mean, you have a main sort of melodic line, but then you also have some harmonization off of that melodic line, and you also have some melodic motifs that come up at some point or other during the work or maybe in one movement or another, and that's part of the richness of the work as a whole, and that's also characteristic of literary works. They don't just do one thing. There are other motifs and themes that are part of the work, even if you're recognizing a main melodic line. And I think a good example actually would be the Gospel of John, because if you work through the prologue of John and see all the themes of life and light and believing in Christ's name, and the theme of becoming a child of God and the glory of God dwelling with His people. I mean, you look at all the different themes that are introduced right at the beginning of John, you realize you've got a book here that has some real thematic complexity. You're not just going to be able to boil it down to just one thing. It's going to have to be something that has some richness and where you're recognizing the full grandeur and beauty of the work, you're recognizing its melodic complexity. Nevertheless, I do think, by and large, you'll find in the biblical books that there is a melodic line which will help give coherence to preaching, particularly a series of sermons, and may sometimes be very important for clarifying exactly why this particular passage is part of the wider book. It's something that helps us in our interpretation. Now, let's talk about Exodus, which is going to be our main focus this hour and our main focus for the week. And, of course, the problem with Exodus is, what do you do after chapter 20? That's you know, really the problem with Exodus, isn't it? Because you've got the call of Moses at the beginning, and you have Moses going to Pharaoh, and you have all the plagues, and that all culminates in the the deliverance through the Red Sea, and then you have a little bit of wilderness wandering, and then you get to Mount Sinai, and you have the Ten Commandments in chapter 20. Now, how many of you could immediately write down as clear an outline as I've just given of the first 20 chapters? How many of you would be able to do that same kind of outline for the last 20 chapters? Well, I mean, I think you'd probably find it, most of us would probably find it a little bit more difficult because that material is not taught in Sunday school as often as the first part of Exodus. It's not preached very often. I mean, I've certainly talked to preachers that have, you know, done the sort of story parts of Exodus, and it's, I mean, it's going along great. You've got all kinds of drama. You have a genocidal villain, and you have a very improbable hero in Moses, and you've got some very interesting narrative setbacks. I mean, Moses initially tries to deliver the Israelites one Egyptian at a time, and that doesn't work out too well, and so there's a big setback in the narrative, and you wonder how he's going to actually fulfill God's purpose. And you've got all of these great special effects. I mean, the burning bush and the, you know, the fire on the mountain. And you've got some huge battle scenes, a lot of violence. You know, some nice musical numbers. I mean, what more do you want in preaching? You've got some good arguments, some great settings. I mean, Egypt and the pyramids, and you know, the wilderness and Mount Sinai. I mean, it's just all great stuff. Now, then you get the law, you get the Ten Commandments. I mean, there's a lot you can do with that as well. It's not quite as dramatic, but you get a lot of mileage out of it for preaching because, as it turns out, those are the kinds of sins a lot of people like to commit. And so there's a lot to say about, you know, in preaching about them. Okay, now what are you going to do with the second half, though? What are you going to do for kind of an encore? You have a lot of case laws. Let me just give you an example. Turn to Exodus 21, 28 and 29. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in and kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall also be put to death. I mean, how are you going to preach that? How are you going to preach that in a gospel-centered way? What about 22, 29, and 30? Exodus 22, 29, and 30. You shall not delay to offer from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall be with its mother. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be consecrated to me, therefore you shall not eat any flesh that is torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. What are you going to do with that? I mean, surely there's something more to be said about it than don't eat roadkill. But, you know, how do we understand that in a New Covenant context? I mean, I think, do you see the difficulty? It's going to be a little tougher, a few more challenges for the preacher. Or what about this? What about all the instructions on the tabernacle? You turn to chapter 25. You have contributions for the sanctuary. You have then very detailed instructions, how to make the Ark of the Covenant, how to make the table for bread, how to make the golden lampstand, and so on and so forth. All the curtains, the wood and the gold and the bronze and how you put the pillars up to make the curtains and what kinds of loops you put over the curtains. You've got all of that in chapters 25 to 28, and then when you get to chapter 36, you have end of 35 and then into chapter 36, you have all of that again, a second time. Whole sections of it that are repeated, in some cases virtually verbatim, and you're going to have to go back and preach all of that material again. I mean, that's going to be a challenge. You do have some help in, you know, chapters 32 and 33 of the golden calf. You know, a lot of interesting things going on there. You've got a story you can work with, but then you're right back into the tabernacle. I mean, how are you going to preach a law code and a set of blueprints and still keep up the sense of narrative momentum that you have in the series. Now, I in fact, have actually preached all the way through Exodus, but I have a lot of sympathy, having done that, for saying, you know, it's enough for us to just do expository preaching up through chapter 20. But even so, you would still want to know what the melodic line is that's tying the whole book together, if in fact there is a melodic line that does so. Now, as you read some of the commentators, particularly some of the ones in a more liberal direction, they'll say, well, this is just kind of two or maybe three books kind of put together. You've got this sort of great narrative that leads you up to Mount Sinai, and then you've got obviously some other, you know, you've got some constitutional documents, and you've got some, you know, somebody was interested in architecture and they put in the blueprints for the tabernacle, and so that's in there, but it doesn't really have a literary coherence. Is there a thematic link? Is there a thread that ties the whole book together? Is there a melodic line? Now, how do we find it, if there is? The outline that the notes that Dave gave us earlier have some very helpful instructions. If you look on the sheet, you'll see under melodic line, here are some things that you look for. And I'm going to be illustrating a couple of those in what I say about Exodus. One thing you look for is something that is repeated throughout the book. Hopefully something that is repeated that in some way seems close to the center of its message. Something that runs all the way through, and especially if it's something that has a kind of stress at the end of the book where you have a sense of tying things together. Something repeated in the book that runs through the book. That's one way to do it. Another way to find the melodic line for Old Testament books is to see what the New Testament says about the Old Testament book, because often that will give you a kind of clue to what really holds the narrative together. A good example of this, I think, is what James says at the end of James in chapter 5, 17 and 18 in his commentary on Elijah. And I remember Dick Lucas teaching on this in London. You know, what does James say about Elijah? He looks at the ministry of Elijah and he says, now there is a man of prayer. He's a regular guy. He's a person just like we are. But he prayed and it did not rain, and he prayed again and it did rain. And then Dick would take us back through the Elijah stories from the perspective of prayer and the answers to prayer, and you see how many things fall into place when you do that with Elijah. I mean, why is there a drought in the first place? Well, James is telling us because Elijah prayed, and that actually makes a lot of sense, because drought was the divinely ordained punishment for idolatry. And so Elijah must have been praying that God would bring the appropriate punishment. I mean, he discerned what was happening in the lives of the people in that day. Well, now you're off and running from the beginning of Elijah with a clear idea of something, a melodic line, a motif that's going to help tie the thing together. And the New Testament has given you a key to unlock it that you may not come up with on your own once you start working through the passages in Elijah, and you see him praying for the resurrection of the dead, praying for God's provision, praying for God to come down with fire. I mean, then it does fall into place. You see the logic of the New Testament, but it's the New Testament that gave you the key to begin with. Now, in this case, I think there is an important word that gets repeated in important places through the book of Exodus, and that's where I want to start. I want to begin by looking at Exodus 14. Now, surely, if there's one passage in the whole book of Exodus we're going to be looking for some kind of clue, for something that holds the whole book together, we're going to want to see it in Exodus 14, which is the Red Sea crossing itself, the very Exodus. And you have here, and furthermore, it's not just that this episode is central to Exodus, but it's really central to the whole message of salvation in the Old Testament and arguably the Bible. It's the central act of salvation in the Old Covenant. And there's an important word that gets repeated in a number of places here. One of the key words in all of Scripture, it's the word glory. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel, I'm reading at verse 1, to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal-Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Now, this is typical of the way God operates all the way through Scripture. He doesn't just do things, He also says things. And when He says things that explain why He does the things that He has done. And here He is saying that His purpose in defeating the Egyptians is to gain glory for Himself, to reveal that He is in fact the Lord, capital L. And this stated intention is confirmed and expanded upon in verses 17 and 18. God says, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now, anytime something is repeated, particularly in close proximity like this, I mean, it almost seems redundant. But, you know, the Hebrew doesn't have any exclamation marks. So typically, if something, the writer wants to emphasize something and put an exclamation mark by it, it will be done by means of repetition. And that's what you find here. It's a repetition of the demonstration of the glory of God, the weightiness of His divine being. And here, God commits Himself to demonstrating that glory, showing that He is the Lord by, on the one hand, rescuing His people and, at the same time, defeating the Egyptians. Now, I think if you read the Song of Moses in chapter 15, you get some clear indications that Moses is starting to understand what God is doing, that he's been paying attention to what God said about why He would rescue His people. And just take a, I'll give you 2 minutes. I'm going to give you less time than David did. Well, maybe 3 minutes. Talk with your partner. What clues do you get in the Song of Moses in chapter 15 that Moses was paying attention to what God said about gaining glory for Himself? Okay, that's probably enough time to at least make a start. What are the clues here you get that Moses is picked up on this glory theme? Somebody shout one out for us. He has triumphed gloriously. Which are you're in verse 1 already, right from the beginning. The glorious triumph of God. The glory of God revealed in His victory. Okay, what else? Okay, what do you have there, Kent? It is. You've got it right at the beginning of what is said and right at the end. It's glory from beginning to end. Okay? What other clues? Yeah, Todd?
The use of name, verse 3.
Okay, I mean, that's a good point, actually. And Todd's saying that when God talks about His name and showing His name, that's virtually synonymous with glory, because what is glory? Glory is the sum total of the godness of God. Well, what is the name of God? It's not just his title. It's not just His handle. It actually represents the totality of His being. So those two things are very closely associated. And actually, in what we looked at in chapter 14, you saw name and glory brought into very close proximity there as well. So so that certainly could be included here. What were you saying? Okay. Awesome in glorious deeds. Okay. What other thing? Yeah, go ahead.
Verse 7, and the greatness of
okay? And actually, we're seeing an important point here, which is I'm starting, just to tell you where I'm going with the melodic line in Exodus, I'm starting with the vocabulary of glory, because that's often how you get started thematically, noticing particular words that get repeated. But you guys are rightly already expanding that a little bit, not just the word glory, but it's the concept of glory and the things that go with it. And majesty, the name of God, I mean, these things are things that are closely associated with his glory. Any other verses that we should touch on? Any other clues in this that Moses is picking up on the theme of that God has introduced in chapter 14? Okay. In the sense of, okay, how the other nations are responding to God, that's a sort of, I mean, it gives you kind of a clue how glorious God is. What about the fact that Moses is singing? What about just that fact? Let alone of the individual things that he says about the glory of God, the actual verses, but what about the act of singing, which is really a way of glorifying God? Moses is understanding the point in a pretty deep way. God has done something glorious. What is the suitable or fitting response to that? I think when you have a sort of grand act of salvation like this, you can't just have a drama. It has to be a musical. And that's what Moses has given us in the book of Exodus. And that's very resonant with this theme of the glory of God. Now, let's press on. Let's look at chapter 16. The children of Israel are out in the wilderness. They're desperate for food. You've got the words of their grumbling in the opening chapter, and then God, opening verses, and then, verse 3, they practically want to die. And, you know, it's very exaggerated, histrionic. And God responds to them with the promise of his provision. And notice what is said in verse 7. In the morning, you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. And God does provide for his people. And if you look down in verse 10, God does make a demonstration of his glory, not just glorifying himself by providing, although I think that may be part of the context here, but there's actually a visible manifestation of the glory of God. Verse 10, as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. Now we're talking about glory, not just in the sense of the invisible attributes of God, but some visible display of his glory in a shining, luminous, radiant, resplendent cloud, sometimes called the Shekinah glory, the glory cloud, which is the visible manifestation of God's invisible glory. What Jonathan Edwards called an effulgence or emanation of light from a luminary. In this case, the luminary being God himself. And of course, this is part of God's accommodating himself to us and to his people, actually giving us something very tangible, and his people something very tangible that they can actually see that would give them a sense of the gloriousness of God. And this has happened on certain rare occasions that are recorded for us in Scripture. Now, this glory cloud appears again in chapter 24. That's another chapter, another place we should look for this theme of glory in the book of Exodus. This is that remarkable incident when Moses and the 70 elders go up the mountain, and the people were down below, and Moses had prepared the people for the renewal of the covenant, and they had made burnt offerings and sacrifices, and Moses read the book of the covenant. And this was the time when he took the sacrificial blood and actually sprinkled it on the people. He was making covenant, and it was a symbolic promise of atonement. And then Moses goes up the mountain. And, I mean, these are remarkable verses. Verse 9, Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. I mean, just even what may be involved in that is amazing to think about. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. Here is a... covenant meal of fellowship. It's interesting to me. It says that they saw God, but then when it actually, Moses actually gets around to describing it, it looks like all they see is the pavement under the feet of God. That's all that they could bear to look at, or all that they could actually see, that God's glory was even above and beyond that. And then after that, as these men have approached the glory of God, and they have come close to the glory of God, Moses goes on up the mountain by himself, and verses 15 to 18 describe him going up into the cloud, this cloud that covers the mountain, verse 15. Verse 16, the glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days, and then God calls to Moses out of the midst of the cloud, and then this glory of the Lord is described for us like a devouring fire on top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain. And so here is a closer encounter with the glory of God, where Moses, as this privileged mediator for the people of Israel, is actually entering into the cloud of the glory of God, this fiery cloud of divine glory. The glory of God is also reflected in the tabernacle. Let's press on to chapter 28. You get a couple of little hints in some of the descriptions of the garments for Aaron and his sons. Notice verse 2, it says, "You shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for glory and for beauty." This is the purpose of these priestly garments. They are for glory and for beauty, and it doesn't spell out the full implications of that. Obviously, there's an aesthetic sensibility here. If Aaron is going to go into the presence of God in the tabernacle and is going to serve the Lord in that place, even his garments have to reflect something of the character of the God that he serves. They really ought to be beautiful garments for that purpose, and they ought to have something of glory about them, set apart in holiness for God. And I think the unstated reason for this is that these are the attributes of God himself, his holiness, his beauty, his glory, the things described in this verse. If you go down to verse 40, you find something similar about the clothing for Aaron's sons, coats, sashes, caps. You shall make them for glory and beauty. And then when you get to the end of chapter 29, I think the point of all of that perhaps is made a little bit more explicit. God is summarizing what he said about the work of the priests, and he says in verse 43, "There I will meet with the people of Israel, and it," that is the tabernacle, "shall be sanctified by my glory." Here is a building constructed for the glory of God, and it makes sense then that something of glory is evident even in the garments of the men who are called to serve there. The whole tabernacle will be made holy or sanctified by the presence of God, and that presence is explicitly said to be a glorious presence, that God is present in glory. Notice what is said in verse 46, or actually 45. Maybe I should read all of these verses. Verse 43, "I will meet with the people of Israel, and it shall be sanctified by my glory. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar." Verse 45, "I will dwell among the people of Israel and will be their God, and they shall know that I am the Lord their God." And that is repeated at the end of verse 46, "I am the Lord their God." The whole point here is knowing God to be God, and specifically in the context of his glorious presence. If you know the story of Exodus, you know this takes a more personal turn when you get to chapter 33. That's the chapter where Moses, chapter 33, verse 18, has, I think, to an even greater extent, has been understanding this theme of the glory of God. He has a sense that God wants to reveal his glory, that his people are destined to behold his glory. And so Moses finally says in verse 18, "Show me the glory. Please show me your glory." And God explains that Moses cannot bear a full sight of the glory of God. He has to be sheltered in this cleft in the rock, but he will at least get to see the backside of God's glory. And verse 22 describes the passing by of the glory of God. Are you seeing how frequently some of the vocabulary of glory is showing up in Exodus? And at key junctures, deliverance, provision, law, covenant meal, tabernacle. It's running right through the central events of the book of Exodus. And then it comes right at the very end of the book, Exodus chapter 40. Almost a kind of tedious chapter. I mean, Moses very deliberately and somewhat laboriously sets up each part of the tabernacle, and he puts the altar for incense in place, and he puts the bronze altar for sacrifice in place. And I think what's supposed to be happening is you're supposed to have a sense of anticipation, because God has promised that he will dwell in this place, and everything's getting set up one by one, each element. And then finally at the end, in what is truly the climax of Exodus, the cloud covers the tent of meeting, verse 34, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. This truly is the ultimate climax of Exodus, not even so much the deliverance through the Red Sea, but the descent of God in glory to be with his people. And this has particular importance because it happens right at the end of the book, and right at the end of the book is when things tend to get tied together for us. And this is, you know, highly ironic, I think, verse 35, and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. The whole point of the building was that here was a place where you could go and meet with God. And then at the end of the book, God actually comes down in glory. And he's so glorious, you can't even enter the building because that's how much glory is there. And it gives us a sense of the awesome and transcendent glory of the holiness of God. Now, all of that is just, so far, just explicit vocabulary of glory, not even some of the broader themes that we could look at. And I think already you have a pretty good case for glory as the melodic line of Exodus. But now let's step beyond that. And let's look for a little bit of confirmation. Let me just mention this. You could get some confirmation in Psalm 106, but we're not going to look at it. But let's look at Luke chapter 9, which may be one of our passages. Have we already done Luke 9, or is that still coming up? It's coming up. Okay. I won't spoil too much of that, I don't think. Luke 9 is it's one of the gospel stories of the Transfiguration. And the point I want to make is, when you look at some of the main New Testament passages that relate to the Exodus, particularly some of the longer ones that develop the meaning of Exodus with a little more fullness, not surprisingly, glory is an important theme in those passages, which I think provides a kind of confirmation that whatever we want to say about the melodic line of Exodus, it's going to have something to do with the glory of God. Certainly you see that here, because you have the transfiguration of Jesus Christ. You have him appearing in his glory, in his dazzling splendor. And notice that Moses and Elijah also appear in glory. Do you see that in verse 31? Moses and Elijah were talking with Jesus. They appeared in glory and spoke of his departure. But if you know the Greek, you know it's actually the word exodus. And you can have a good time in your groups tomorrow teasing out all of the meanings and implications of that. But I simply want to point out that we're talking about the glory, and it's really appropriate and fitting that Moses should be there in this context, related in some way to the glory of Christ and himself appearing in glory. That resonates with the story of Moses in the Old Testament and what we find in the book of Exodus. Here again we have the Shekinah glory of God, this glorious cloud, a visible manifestation of the glory of God. We are breathing the glory atmosphere of Exodus on the Mount of Transfiguration with Moses and Elijah and Jesus. Or turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Let's just take this as a little bit of an exercise with your partner, probably beginning... the whole of 2 Corinthians 3 is relevant to this, but what are the various ways, what are some of the different ways in which glory and the glory of Exodus is referred to here in 2 Corinthians chapter 3? Take 3 minutes to brainstorm a little bit with a neighbor. 2 Corinthians 3. Poke your neighbor in the ribs if he's drowsy. You working with a partner, Russ, or just freelancing? Okay. Freelancing together, okay. Let's share a couple of answers here. What are some of the main things that are said about glory as it relates to Exodus and either events in Exodus or the meaning of Exodus? What are you noticing in these verses? You finding any confirmation of glory as a melodic line in Exodus? Okay. The writing of the law, the Decalogue, came with glory. What verses do we, verse 7, okay? The letters on stone, but coming, they come with glory. Okay, what else? Okay, talk to us about the veil a little bit. Right. Interestingly, the Exodus doesn't actually say that Moses' face was glorious in so many words. It does talk about it shining, obviously, and you get a little sense of the reaction that people had to that. You could kind of see from how Aaron's responding what it might have been like. But here it's very explicitly called glory, that's what Moses is shining with. It's glory that is reflected from the being and the character of God. And so that's an example of something from Exodus that's suffused with glory, even though the vocabulary of glory doesn't come up in so many words. Anything else here that relates to the glory theme in Exodus? Okay. Todd, everybody's depending on you. You're like David going out against Goliath. The champion of the whole workshop. Right. No, I'm commending you. But
the sending of the presence in Exodus,
okay. Okay. It's related to the ministry of the Spirit here. That's part of the glory theme that Paul is developing. I mean, one thing that I would point out is how frequently glory comes up here. It's like the main vocabulary word in this whole passage. It's a way of saying, look, the ministry of Moses and what God was doing with the law and giving it, it's all about glory. And Paul's whole argument here depends on the gloriousness that was demonstrated in the Exodus and in that whole administration. Now, the point that he's building up to make, I mean, it's one of those how much more arguments. There is a surpassing glory. There is an infinitely greater degree of glory in the person and work of Jesus Christ. But there is a continuity between the old and the new, and the old itself had glory in it. Paul's whole argument here depends on the understanding the degree to which the whole Mosaic administration was an administration of glory. We would find a similar kind of argument in Hebrews chapter 3, although we're not going to take the time to look at it now. So here's what we've done so far. We've looked at vocabulary of glory, repeated vocabulary through the book. We've looked at New Testament that seems to provide some insight or confirmation of the melodic line that we're coming up with. But we're still not finished with it because we don't want to limit ourselves just to the vocabulary of glory. Let me just remind you of a couple other things that happen in Exodus that are deeply related to a revelation of the glory of God. One is the burning bush, where God reveals his sacred divine name, and we've already touched on the connection between name and glory, but this is a miracle that in some sense gives us a little bit of a glimpse of the glory of God, and Moses has a sense of that, of the holiness of God. He hides himself from this presence of God, and God announces to Moses his glorious divine name. This conveys something of the fullness of his divine being. Or think about the demand that Moses makes of Pharaoh on behalf of God. It's not just, let my people go. It is, let my people go so that they can worship me, so that they can glorify me, so that they can offer sacrifices to me. That's talked about in different ways. Chapter 3, verse 18 talks about sacrifices. Chapter 5, verse 1 talks about a feast for God in the wilderness. Chapter 7, verse 16, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. Similarly, that language of serving God comes up a number of times in chapters 8 and chapter 9. And when Pharaoh finally relents, as he does in chapter 12, verse 31, he says that he is letting the Israelites go to serve the Lord. He himself is sort of understanding, okay, it's not just go, it's go for this purpose of serving, or you might say glorifying God. It has to do with the people giving honor and worship to God. That's very much related to the idea of glory and giving God the glory. Sometimes some of those passages, and we may look at this a little bit more later, some people think Moses is being a little deceptive. I mean, he's not just wanting to go into the wilderness to worship the Lord. I mean, he's leaving altogether, but that's really missing the point. It's not even so much the leaving altogether that's the point. It is the leaving so that they can actually serve the Lord and not be under the slavery of Pharaoh, so that they can give God the glory that he deserves. This theme of glory, I think, explains also the plagues and why God delivered his people the way that he did. To see this, look at chapter 12, verse 12. You'll remember the 12 terrible plagues, you know, the frogs and the gnats and the blood and all the rest of it. Why did God deliver his people that way specifically? I mean, he could have surely delivered the people in some other way. Certainly could have done it sooner had he chosen to do so. But notice what is said in 12, verse 12. I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. This is how God is viewing his judgment on the Egyptians. It is the defeat of their gods. The issue that is really at stake is which god or gods deserve the glory. And you can walk through each of the 10 plagues, and you can show how the plagues relate to one or another of the Egyptian deities. I mean, all of the Nile, the gods of the Nile, they were defeated when God showed his superior power over the Nile River. The god of fertility was defeated, in a sense, when the country was overrun with frogs. The bull gods were defeated when the cattle were afflicted with disease and died. And then it all culminates, and we'll be talking about this in the next hour, in the defeat of the two greatest gods of Egypt, the sun god and Pharaoh himself, who was considered to be the son of the god. See, God is defeating all of the gods of Egypt. He's not just getting his people out of there, but he is doing it in a way that demonstrates his superiority over those other deities. That's a manifestation of his glory. Or the Ten Commandments. Here's another place where we see the glory of God, particularly in the way the Ten Commandments begin. What's the whole point here? I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. God is making an affirmation of his superiority, his supremacy, the unique glory of his name. He is insisting from the outset of the commandments that he will not share his glory with any other god. You see, it's not just the vocabulary of glory we find in Exodus, but the real meaning of glory in the being and the character and the salvation of God. And so when I was preaching through Exodus, I just expressed it in a very simple way. This is the book about the sort of melodic line is saved for God's glory. It has something to do with salvation. I mean, we can't leave out the great Exodus deliverance of the Red Sea. But it is for this purpose. It is for the glory of God, for the glory of God himself, for the glory of God demonstrated in the worship of his people. Probably you could, and you might think about this during the week in your workshop and so forth, you could expand on that definition a little bit and make a fuller description of the melodic line of Exodus. But if you wanted a simple one, save for the glory of God. That's the melodic line of Exodus. Now, how will this help you in preaching? Let me just give a few thoughts about this as we close. I would note, first of all, this gives you a theme for Exodus that is very close to the central message of the Bible and also happens to be the main goal of the Christian life. I'm hoping that some of you who aren't Presbyterians at least know the first answer to our Presbyterian catechism. What is the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Well, Exodus is a wonderful book for unfolding that theme in the life of the people of God and in their pilgrimage. This is the whole goal of the Christian life. Now and for eternity, it is the glorification of God. And God's purpose, his chief end, is to manifest his own glory, and he has done it in a marvelous way in all of the events of the book of Exodus. Somehow it makes sense, doesn't it, that the book in the Old Testament that has the central act of deliverance in the Old Testament has the glory of God as its main theme, so that we see how glorious God is in the provision of salvation. And so if we have a melodic line now that helps us preach the book of Exodus, focusing on the thing that ought to be the focus for all of life, and that is the glory of God. It's interesting when Jonathan Edwards wrote his famous book on the end for which God created the world and started demonstrating the glory of God in his saving work. He referred to, I think, all of the glory texts from Exodus that we looked at. I mean, he was impressed with the manifestation of God's glory in the book of Exodus. I think this is something that helps you understand everything in the book a little bit better. And maybe a lot of melodic lines are like this. It reminds me a little bit of the commercial for Philips, I think it is. We don't make the light bulb, but we make it brighter. What are the other things in their commercials? We don't make this or that, but we're somewhere behind the scenes making everything better. And the melodic line, this melodic line of the glory of God, I think brings a sort of brightness or clarity to each element or each aspect, each progressive step in the story of the Exodus. And even where glory isn't present in so many words, it's part of the radiance of the book as a whole. I also think this theme of glory helps you understand the dramatic tension, particularly through the early part of the book. Why does it really matter that Pharaoh is oppressing the Israelites? It's not just because he's a bad guy and you shouldn't put people in slavery. It's not just a sort of perennial story of genocide or oppression. What is really at stake is the honor of God. Will he be glorified or not? And will his people have the freedom and the joy to give him the glory that he deserves? And that dramatic tension now is taking us right to the heart of the meaning of the whole universe. The problem with Pharaoh is he wants other people to serve him, and so he won't let them serve God. And it's all about his own glory and the damage and restraint and restriction that puts on other people. It's interesting. I think a clear place you see this is chapter 9, verses 16 and 17. This is one of the places where God announces his intention for the Exodus. "For this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. You are still exalting yourself against my people and will not let them go. See, it's a way of God telling Pharaoh that he's living for his own glory. And this is the conflict. It's all around this ruler who will not glorify God but only himself. The glory of God makes sense of the plagues. We've talked about that. I think the theme of glory helps us understand why God actually destroyed the Egyptians. I mean, in one sense, he could have simply rescued the Israelites and just left the Egyptians alone, but that would not have been as full a display of his glory, and particularly the glory of God in judgment and in justice. And that is actually something to sing about. And Moses understood that. That's why you have the Song of Moses in chapter 15. You see, these people will not give God the glory with their own lips, and therefore, in the end, they will give God the glory the only way that they are able to, which is as a manifestation of his justice. And I think when we understand that, we ourselves are ready to sense the joy of Exodus 15. It's not just the joy that the Israelites win, it's also joy that the Egyptians have been defeated. That's very clear. It's not just that God has triumphed, but that the horse and the rider have been thrown into the sea, and God is to be glorified for that. Glory helps us understand the purpose of the Ten Commandments. Here's a guide for glorifying God. It also begins to put into place, I think, all of those case laws, which are very specific. I mean, your ox goring your neighbor and all of that. But see, all of life is for the glory of God, and even some of the mundane and practical details, which are laid out by way of case examples that help us understand whole categories of human life, these things too are under the glory of God, and these aspects of life are to be lived for his glory. That isn't, stated in so many terms in any particular verse I can show you, but I think the melodic line helps you put those things into place and understand their proper place in the book as a whole. I also think this theme of the glory of God helps put the tabernacle into place, because here is a building for the glory of God, and God has given very specific instructions for it, and they may seem overly detailed to us, but that building is important because that is the earthly dwelling place for the glory of God. That's the importance and significance of the tabernacle. That also helps us put into place the golden calf, because that's a way for the people to say, well, no, we're going to glorify God our own way. We've got our alternative worship service here. We've got a different way of glorifying God, and we want to glorify him this way, and that's what arouses the anger of Moses and the justice of God. It's the glory of God that is at stake in the whole episode of the golden calf, and God is exercising his jealousy over his own glory and own worship. And then the tabernacle is not a sort of add-on to the Exodus. In a way, it's kind of the point, because here's a place where the glory of God can come down to earth. That's the direction that the story of the Exodus is actually moving. Will God really come down and dwell in glory with his people? And when you see the significance of that question, I think you understand the end of the book for the climax that it really is. I also would note, finally, that seeing this melodic line helps you apply the Exodus to the Christian life. Here's a grand narrative that is also the story of the Christian pilgrimage. This is the story of our salvation. Glory that we rob from God and that can only be returned to God by an act of redemption. I mean, here you see the nature of Adam's sin played out in the life of Pharaoh, pursuing his own ungodly glory. You see the struggle between God and Satan through history. It's really the struggle for our own soul. You see the coming of a Savior who can rescue you and reestablish the worship of God. These are some of the themes that come in that deeply relate to the Christian life. Will I be the kind of person who glorifies God or not? And the answer the Exodus gives is, by the grace of God, I will become that kind of person, and I, in the end, too, like Moses, will enter into the very glory of God himself. Let's stop there. I think James is here. Let's start at 4:15. Is that all right?
Yep.
gives us a sort of, I don't know, that's somewhere between a long and a short break. That's a medium break.